Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I'm your host, Massimo Pilducci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Geliff. Julia, what are we going to talk about today?
Massimo, today we're going to talk about the science of applied rationality, Ooh. Which is a phrase that is near and dear to my heart since I sort of came up with it. The name of the organization of which I am now the president is the Center for Applied Rationality, or CFAR for short. And so the science that we're going to talk about today is the science that inspired the founding of our organization. Basically, it's...
So first of all, before you go ahead, is there such a thing as a misapplied rationality?
Yes, I would argue that there
yes,
is.
Yes, I think actually that's true. Okay, go ahead.
The idea behind applied rationality is that cognitive science has learned a lot over the last few decades about cognitive biases, about the systematic errors that the human brain commits when we try to reason or make decisions, and specifically what contexts or situations or you know, environmental factors cause us to commit cognitive biases. And so there's been this wonderful proliferation of research in the field of heuristics and biases about how our brains go wrong. But what there hasn't been nearly as much of is research on how to fix it, on how to de-bias ourselves. And there definitely hasn't been anyone so far until my organization trying to take that research and use it to help people not make those mistakes in their own decisions about their career or their health or finances or personal relationships, and also the decisions that they make about that affect society as a whole, like the decisions they make about who to vote for, or how to treat other people, or where to donate their money, that sort of thing. So essentially, applied rationality means using what cognitive science has learned about the human brain to improve our decision making.
But so wait a minute, because the first thing that I thought when I started reading about this is, well, don't the rest of us call this teaching? I mean, after all, isn't the whole idea of teaching, let's say, about critical thinking or logical fallacies or something like that, isn't that part of the idea?
Yeah, this is definitely an example of teaching. One of our core premises is that you can't reliably cause any kind of significant change in the way people reason or make decisions just by telling them about cognitive biases that they're vulnerable to, or telling them about principles of logic and reasoning. You have to actually have more in-depth, intensive practice of good decision-making habits examples from the domain where you want people to be improving their decision-making. So in this case, on real-life case studies.
Right. So I was talking about, let's talk about a different example. I suppose it's a related example, like, you know, gambling-related fallacies, right? So the fact that people have sort of intuitively pretty bad intuitions about probabilistic thinking, right?
Right, like if it's come up red three times so far, then we're due for a black.
Yes, exactly, that sort of stuff. Now, I would think that that's a very well known phenomenon. I mean, that's been known for a while that people are bad at doing that sort of engaging in that kind of reasoning, which of course is one of the reasons why gambling casinos do so well. Now, if you teach a course in probability theory or applied statistics, or for that matter, even a general course in critical thinking in a philosophy class, that is certainly one of the topics you're going to cover. And I would hope, I guess, that once somebody's been told, perhaps better, as you were saying, through examples, because it's always better if people work out their own examples anyway, regardless of what we're talking about. It definitely makes a more of an impact if you're told not just about the theory, but you also actually worked your way through specific situations, right? It's easier to internalize that way. So that is the kind of thing that people have been doing, right, for a while. I mean, I'm talking about sort of within an academic setting. If you take a course in applied statistics or in philosophy of critical thinking or something like that, that is the sort of thing that people are exposed to. Or is there something radically different that we're also talking about? So are we talking about bringing the kind of things that people either are doing or should be doing in the classroom also to a non-standard audience, sort of outside of a college setting or
well,
what?
So it is outside of a college setting.
Right.
I mean, we're an independent 501c3 nonprofit, and most of our workshops are for adults 18 and up, although we are right now running a workshop for exceptionally talented high schoolers called SPARK, the Summer Program on Applied Rationality and Cognition. But this is all outside of sort of standard curricula. We might at some point try to get applied rationality modules developed for standard public school or college curricula, but we haven't done that yet. Actually, that's not entirely true. We are working with someone at UC Berkeley, a Nobel laureate physicist, actually, named Saul Perlmutter. So after Perlmutter won the Nobel Prize, he decided that what he now wanted to use his newfound glory and fame and connections for was to spread rationality and rational decision making. So he's designing a class on rational decision making for Berkeley undergrads, and we're helping him with that. So I guess that's an exception to what I just said. What was your question? Oh, so your question was about how is what you're doing different from the standard way that critical thinking is taught?
Right. Well, for instance, let me ask, yeah. Why would a physicist, with all the due respect to somebody who won the Nobel Prize, engage in designing a course in critical thinking?
Oh, well,
I mean,
critical thinking is pretty important to practicing science well.
Yes, but most scientists, and I can tell this from personal experience, don't actually think about critical thinking. I mean, that's what they learn automatically, but they wouldn't know how to teach it.
I guess that's part of why he's bringing in outside help.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, you're right. Part of what he's trying to do is think explicitly about the principles that underlie what he does as a scientist, which
okay.
he may not actually have ever explicitly considered before. But this is sort of a tangent from your original question, which is what is it about the way we're teaching applied rationality that differs from the way it's presented in standard curricula? So the practice of giving people examples and practice problems that you described is great, and it's much better than just giving people passively receive information. The latter seems, pretty incredibly unlikely to work. The former, giving people examples and practice problems, seems more likely to work. But there's still, unfortunately, this problem of domain transfer, which is one of the big sticking points in successful critical thinking education, which is that people, even if they can learn a concept in one domain, and that domain might be statistics, like a field, a particular
right.
class, or it might be a context of school, like problems I do in school with a paper and pen. Even if you get people to successfully learn a concept and get all of their practice problems right, the trick then is still to get them to recognize when in real life they're in a situation where that principle applies. So like maybe, in statistics class, you can get people to easily understand the gambler's fallacy and the fact that, flipping a coin each time is independent, and so past coin flips have no bearing on what you should expect for the next coin flip. So they get that perfectly. They get, all the problems on their test right. But then, they're out in the world and they've let's see, what would be a real-world example of this? I don't know. Maybe they're playing the lottery or something, and they feel like they're due for a win. Or maybe that's actually too similar. Maybe it would have to be something like, I don't know, asking someone out. Maybe they feel like they're due for a win.
Wait a minute. Are you talking about dating as gambling?
I'm talking about dating as repeated trials with some probability of success each time.
Okay.
Although it's not a perfect example because you presumably get better each time.
I would think so, yes.
At successfully asking someone out.
Right.
The basic point here is that people don't, it doesn't even occur to them that what they learned in their statistics class is going to apply in this context that's not labeled statistics or not
right.
labeled, use critical thinking here. So that's
right.
really the trick in effective debiasing.
Okay, but let's stay on that for a second. That is, that's a general problem in education, period. It is in fact difficult to extend the domain of application of what people learn,
right.
even in standard.
So in most of education, you're not trying to get people to behave differently in their everyday lives. You're getting them to understand and have a familiarity with a particular domain.
Well, that's
so
an interesting
there's less
point
need for domain transfer.
Yeah, that's an interesting point because actually my goal is to affect people's lives when I teach. but yeah, yes, you're right. That's usually not the obvious.
Of education in general, right. Not maybe that doesn't apply so much to what you teach, right. Which is more similar to what I'm teaching.
Right. Now, but what I was going to stay for a second on these problems of cross transferability, because I read one of the articles that you suggested. This is by Scott Lilienfeld and collaborators in the Perspectives on Psychological Science.
Yep.
And one of the interesting things they say is that there is, quote, rather little research demonstrates that critical thinking skills generalize beyond the tasks on which they're taught.
Yep.
Now, of course, the fact that there is rather little, that's a tricky thing to say because the fact that there is rather little research demonstrating critical thinking generalizability doesn't mean that they are not generalizable. It may simply mean a reflect of the fact that very few people have actually done research on it. But I don't know what the broader literature in that area looks like. It certainly is an area where, yes, we ought to have evidence. It would be nice, since there is a lot of talk about critical thinking here and there, and not only at the college level, but at the pre-college level. These days, you can't come across a curriculum in high school that doesn't mention, or even earlier, that doesn't mention critical thinking, which I think is a good thing as a general idea, except, of course, that different people have different ideas about what constitutes critical thinking and how to teach it and, you know, whatever. So certainly more research would be interesting. But one of the things that sort of took me a little aback about this was in the same article. So on the one hand, you know, research on the cross-transferability of critical thinking skills, I think, is in fact a good idea, and apparently it is an open question. What I thought was a little more sort of strange by a strange claim by the authors is this. The capacity to think critically is surprisingly non-generalizable across disciplines, but if you look at the references that they cite there, one of the two references is Feynman 1985, and that's actually Feynman's biography, Richard Feynman's biography, which I don't really think it's a particularly good source of evidence for that kind of claim. And a few lines,
that may be. I don't know what in that biography they were.
I read the biography. I don't see that there. I mean, even if Feynman does claim that he knows people who are very good at thinking in one area and they can't transfer that skill in another area, which is probably what he does say, that hardly counts as anything more than anecdotal evidence, I would think. And then the other one, a few lines later, the same authors say, well, some authors have conjectured that highly intelligent people possess especially effective ideological immune systems, because they're adept at generating plausible counterarguments against competing claims, although this possibility has yet to be tested systematically. Now, that's a fairly big claim, which actually I have heard in the skeptic community, this idea that even smart people do dumb things.
But yeah, well, actually, it wasn't just when smart people do dumb things. I don't know who you're referring to. When I read that, I thought of Michael Shermer and the chapter that he added to the more recent edition of his book, Why People Believe Weird Things.
Right.
The chapter was Why Smart People Believe Weird Things. And
right.
He also has a theory, not based on randomized controlled trials or anything, just based on anecdotal evidence,
right.
That smart people are especially good at coming up with elaborate justifications for why they don't have to update their beliefs in response to evidence,
right.
No matter how convincing that evidence might seem.
And that's that's exactly right. In fact, the authors of that article do cite only Shermer 2002 as a source of evidence. Now, that's interesting because, we both know Michael, and, he's definitely a smart guy, and I read that book, and it's very interesting. And the hypothesis is interesting. I mean, certainly sort of provocative, right? This idea that the smarter you are, the better you are at rationalizing rather than being rational. There may or may not be some truth to that. I don't know. But what does worry me, and this is really tangential to what we're talking about, so the main topic, and I want to go back to that in a second and let you go on with that. But I do think it's an interesting thing that I notice more and more, and this example is just the latest in a long series, technical papers, sort of academic papers, like this one, cite sometimes as sources of evidence or sort of sources in general, books that are really not peer-reviewed and they're actually written for a general public, like Shermer's book. And that sort of worries me, because we're getting to the point where there's this developing this fuzzy category of books where people make fairly bold claims that may, they're interesting, and they may or may not be true. And then these claims sort of enter, find their way into the mainstream academic literature. Some of Richard Dawkins' own books are often quoted, you know, like The Selfish Gene. Mm-hmm. They're often quoted in the primary literature, even though that was a book for the general public. It was not peer-reviewed and all that sort of stuff. It's certainly not original data. So yeah, it kind of worries me about the trend that there's this referring to provocative ideas that in fact have really not been tested. They're just being put out there by interesting people, and it's an interesting provocative idea, but that's about the end of it. There's nothing else to it.
Yeah, this is definitely an interesting point, but completely unrelated to the topic of devising. So,
not entirely, because it is part of the argument that these authors make for why devising is important. Because basically the argument is, look, even really smart people, Feynman 1995, Sherman 2002, can fall prey to these kinds of things. So clearly there is a need for these kinds of interventions. I'm suggesting that the evidence for that particular claim is somewhat sketchy, to say the least.
You're doubting the claim that even smart people do stupid things?
As a systemic thing, yes. I don't think there is any evidence of that. Now there is anecdotal evidence, yes, for sure.
So there is actually evidence in the literature about a lack of a correlation, or just a very weak correlation, between standard measures of intelligence and rationality. And here rationality means evaluating arguments objectively, showing consistency in your, like, very basic fundamental consistency in your preferences and the decisions that you would make in various hypothetical situations, using deliberative reasoning even when you weren't explicitly instructed to. So I'll give you an example.
Yeah, like, no, that claim doesn't surprise me at all, but go ahead, give me an example.
Sure. So there's a series of questions that cognitive psychologists have given to people where, if you rely on your intuitive knee-jerk answer, you'll get the wrong answer. So one example would be, a bat and a ball cost $1.10 in total. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? Mm-hmm. And many, many people just say 10 cents without thinking further about it. It can't actually be right, because if that were true, the ball would have to cost a dollar more, and it would be $1.10, and then the total cost would be $1.20 rather than $1.10. So there's just some sort of intuitive heuristic that people use where they're like, oh, I probably want to like subtract one of these numbers from the other, but right, they're not really thinking carefully about it. So that people's success rate at getting that question right is unrelated or very weakly related to their IQ. Yeah. There's a bunch of other questions like this where, like, if you just thought carefully about it and actually tried to get the right answer instead of just saying the first thing that associatively came to your mind, you would get it right.
Before you go ahead, do you know if there is, so this is the relationship between rationality in this sense and IQ. Do you know if there are, I'm just curious, if there are any data about the relationship between sort of rational deliberative thinking on the one hand and, let's say, scores on sections of the GRE, because the graduate record examination actually measures, supposed to measure, I don't know that it does, but it's supposed to measure precisely that kind of, thinking skills, analytical, deliberative thinking skills. So if nobody's done it, my proposal is that if somebody actually is going to check, is that they're going to find a much higher correlation between rationality and GRE scores rather than rationality and IQ scores.
That may well be. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, so you don't know if there is anybody looked into that. That's an interesting question for our listeners. If anybody knows that, I'd love to know.
So the other piece of interesting evidence I was going to bring up is one of the really common features, or I would say one of the essential features of a rational disposition, is evaluating arguments or evidence objectively, regardless of what, of whether you personally agree with or like the conclusion. So there's this thing that some cognitive psychologists call the my side bias. Biasing the side that you're predisposed to when you're evaluating arguments. And so they've done various tests of my side bias and then correlated it with IQ and other measures of cognitive ability. And again, there's not really very much correlation. So the kinds of experiments that they've done are they present participants with two hypothetical experiments, both of which are quite flawed, and each of which purport to demonstrate some particular conclusion. Mm-hmm. And ask people to point out as many flaws as they can in each of the two experiments. And people are able to come up with many more flaws in the experiment that supports the conclusion they don't like. There are other tests like can people evaluate logically valid reasoning as being logically valid even when it supports a conclusion that they don't like? Can people generate arguments for a position that they don't like? Anyway, so this is another example of rationality not being that connected to IQ. But I don't, you know, even if people who have higher IQs are less disposed or less predisposed to irrational behavior, that still seems worth it to try to debias them, even if, you know, they're not as bad off.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't want to give you the impression that I don't think it's good. It's a good idea to do debias people, as you put it. I was picking a specific bone of contention about, you know, the Feynman and Shermer based citation.
Oh, so Massimo, I'd also wanted to address a question you'd raised a few minutes ago about the paucity of literature on critical thinking actually, like, generalizing to domains outside of the classroom. And it is, like, it would be great if this research had already been done and we already knew exactly what techniques to use to get people to make rational decisions in the rest of their lives. So far, there's been a small amount of research. Like, there's a small set of things that have been shown again and again to work well. And yep. A lot of those are very simple, like a strategy, if you can call it that, a strategy called consider the opposite, which is just the mental yep. habit asking yourself, what is a reason or what are some reasons why the thing I believe might not be true? Or what are right. some reasons why the plan that I think is best might not be the best plan? So this has been repeatedly validated as something that people can learn and that affects their decision-making positively. And then there's also research that that isn't classified technically under the debiasing literature, but is still really relevant and I would call a shining example of applied rationality, and that's cognitive therapy. So cognitive therapy is based around the idea that people's negative emotional reactions are often based on these implicit assumptions or beliefs that they have that they haven't examined and which are often completely distorted, like getting upset when your friend pressures you to have another drink because you assume that she must know you hate that, but actually maybe if you examine the evidence, you'd realize that she has no way of knowing that, or maybe you've given her contrary signals.
Right.
Or, you know, there's a lot of, like, all-or-nothing thinking or jumping to conclusions or focusing on negative people that make unhappy. So cognitive therapy has a really well-validated record of getting people to notice the implicit beliefs causing their emotions, ask themselves what evidence they have for them, how they would test them, and so on. So I think that's a great example of applied rationality in action. And it's also evidence that you can get people to internalize a principle of critical thinking and actually turn it into a habit. That becomes almost instinctive, which is exactly what we want to do.
Right, but if we go that broadly, then isn't the existence and functioning of pretty much every graduate school program another example of applied rationality? I mean, after all, that's precisely the kind of skills you learn in graduate school, and they are pretty successful, judging from the, you know, number of people that then go on with having successful careers and, you know, discover new things and apply what they learn. I mean, after all, when I think of graduate students interacting within a laboratory, for instance, I think of that as an apprenticeship kind of workshop, as you learn. Not just the principles, you know, the theoretical principles, because you're exposed to certain classwork or, you know, theoretical work, but you really literally learn how to apply things on a daily basis, how to reason better on a daily basis. That's precisely what being in graduate school is. Now, I'm not suggesting, of course, that means that we have to put the entire population of the United States through a graduate level course, coursework. But isn't there another example of sort of broadly construed applied rationality, or would you not count that?
So if graduate programs actually did that, if they actually made people rational decision makers in other areas of their life outside of the laboratory, then yeah, I would call that a great example of applied rationality instruction. But they don't seem to do that. I mean, so what we're talking about is getting people to understand not only that they need to be wary of, say, selection bias when they're running experiments, and selection bias here is the problem that the sample that you're looking at to generalize to the population isn't actually representative of the whole population.
Right.
So we want people to not only recognize that that's an issue when they're, you know, doing a statistical analysis, but when they're just collecting informally, collecting evidence from the world about how the world works in ways that are really important to the decisions they're going to make. So in my life, my shining example of selection bias at work, which I failed to recognize at the time, was when I was considering whether or not to go into a PhD program. And I asked a number of professors whether they thought, whether they liked academia, whether they thought I should go into academia. And the response was pretty positive, that they liked academia, they would recommend it. And it was only much later that I realized that I had been selecting from a very biased, very skewed sample of professors, because they're the ones who both could hack it and also liked it enough to stay. I wasn't actually interviewing any of the people who had considered being professors, but right. Abandoned the idea or failed.
Right, but so, you really don't think that, let's say, a graduate student who is learning about, let's say, sampling protocols because of his work isn't going to be able to make that kind of leap and apply it outside? I mean, that's certainly what I did. When I started being aware because I was practicing and because I studied the theory of, let's say, you know, certain issues in sampling and probability distributions and all that sort of stuff, then I started seeing bell curves everywhere, and I started asking myself about everything. Well, is this a Poisson kind of process or not? In other words, is it random or not? It sort of becomes automatic. But you start thinking, you know, you are exposed to new ideas and you practice them within a domain. And I don't know, to me at least, again, this obviously is personal anecdotal evidence, but so I don't pretend that is general, but that to me, this was immediately translated into, oh, you know, whenever, I don't know, maybe I watched the news or something and I was presented with a graph, for instance, then my immediate question was, well, wait a minute, where's the error bar there? Or, you know, how was the sample arrived at, and that sort of stuff? You don't think that translates?
Empirically, it doesn't.
Do we have actual evidence that it doesn't?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So there are studies of statistics students and even statistics professors where they're asked a question that involves a hidden statistical principle like regression to the mean, and the statistic professors and PhD students get it wrong, not quite as much as average statistically naive respondents, but at a very high rate, like much higher than you would expect if they had just internalized all of these principles of statistical thinking and used them, you know, across domains. But maybe you're an exception. I mean, you're unusual in a number of ways, not least of which is that you teach classes on critical thinking and are a public communicator of rationality. So
well,
you're probably
true.
Not a representative case.
I probably am not a representative case. That's true.
Yeah, I mean, there is some evidence.
Yeah, the equivalent in philosophy would be a philosopher who knows about logical fallacies and yet is caught in everyday discourse committing, you know, ad hominem and straw man and all that sort of stuff. I would think that that's just a bad philosophy professor. You know, on the other hand, there is evidence, for instance, that professors of moral philosophy are no more ethical than your average person. So, you know, perhaps that falls into that category as well. You know, you don't practice necessarily what you preach or what you understand at a logical level. So
yeah.
I don't know.
So, Massimo, I don't know if you've yet read Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, but if you haven't, you totally should. It's a great book. And it's full of examples, not just of biases in the general human population, but of biases that Kahneman himself has found himself committing, even though he knows about the bias. But he still finds himself committing, say, the planning fallacy, where you vastly underestimate the amount of time it's going to take you to complete some task. Or the halo effect, where your estimation of the quality of, like, an argument or the quality of an essay that a student wrote is influenced by other completely irrelevant qualities of the person. So, yeah, I mean, if Kahneman himself has trouble has trouble getting past biases, and if statistics professors have trouble noticing when statistical principles apply to everyday situations, it seems biases seem pretty sticky.
Well, yeah, I certainly don't doubt the biases are sticky. I just don't see any way around it other than making people aware of them and practice exercises, basically. So now you mentioned Kahneman. So let's go back to, you know, one of his most famous contributions is this distinction between system one and system two mode thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Where system one mode thinking is sort of automatic and based on heuristics, on presumably subconscious heuristics. Whether mm-hmm. they evolved adaptively or not, I think we should leave entirely out of the question because it doesn't really matter. And it would get us into all sorts of, you know, trouble with evolutionary psychological explanations. The fact of the matter is that it's an indubitable fact that we do have, we do think subconsciously by heuristics, so by shortcuts. So the difference between that and the system two, which is on the other hand sort of control, rule governed, and in fact it has a different brain underpinning, basically. So you move from massive, fast, parallel subconscious processing of information in the case of the heuristics to slower but more deliberate thinking, rational thinking that is actually mediated by essentially sort of conscious processes. Okay, mm-hmm. So the whole idea, therefore, it seems to me, or at least a big part of the idea, however, is to try to teach people to move from a system one to a system two mode of thinking. Is that correct?
Yes. That alone would be great. Getting people trained in using skillfully using system two processes, but also getting them to recognize when system two is actually appropriate, because it's not always appropriate. I mean, if you don't have a lot of time, or if you've developed a really strong intuition just based on repeated experience, then your system one is going to do pretty well. So system two is often appropriate when we don't realize it, but not always. Right. So, but then the next step, which would be desirable, and which we're working on, is getting some of those system two deliberative reasoning habits to become automatic, the way that it's automatic when you notice yourself distorting evidence that's causing you to be anxious or depressed, and instinctively ask yourself, just reflexively, do I actually have good reason to believe that? I don't know how much research there is on that yet, except in the field of cognitive behavioral therapy. But at the very least, it's like an excellent starting point to train people in the deliberative reasoning skills and get them to recognize when they apply.
Right.
But I just wanted to briefly clarify that the system one, system two distinction was actually, that came from Keith Stanovich, who's a cognitive psychologist at U Toronto and the author of a couple of books that I've used as my rationally speaking picks in the past, actually.
Okay.
He's wonderful.
Oh, that's good.
But
know.
Yes, it was popularized by Kahneman.
Right. So now you mentioned a couple of times the sort of behavioral cognitive therapy. When we talked about this in the past, just because I like to make connections as broad as possible sometimes, I mentioned that cognitive behavioral therapy is in some sense applied, the applied version in modern settings of Aristotle's ideas about virtue ethics, right? So Aristotle thought that we have certain habits that come naturally. He was talking about virtues and moral habits, but the same obviously applies to sort of thinking habits. We have certain things that come natural. We have a certain predisposition to do certain things or others, and that if we want to improve on those predispositions, what we need to do is literally practice. Aristotle's idea was that practicing virtues initially is going to be difficult because it doesn't necessarily come natural, except for a few individuals. It doesn't come natural, but the more you practice, the more it's like going to the gym, the easier it becomes, up to the point in which, ideally, it does exactly what you were saying a minute ago, which is it becomes automatic. Right.
Yeah.
Now, there is research that does show that is the case, certainly in the applied situation of cognitive behavioral therapy. But I think more broadly, there is research that shows, for instance, research on expertise, that shows that novices do initially do have the wrong intuitions about how to proceed on certain in a certain domain, let's say playing chess, for instance, and then through mindful practice by paying attention very slowly, so basically engaging system two kind of thinking, they learn how to do it better and better, and then at some point they make the leap of essentially shifting back the newly acquired skills to a system level, system one level. Thing. So it becomes automatic. It's like, you know, it, in some sense, it's like learning how to drive a car. You know, initially, you really have to pay a lot of attention. Then it fortunately, it becomes automatic because otherwise you would have to pay a lot of, you know, make a lot of effort just to drive down the grocery store, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So that seems to be a general human ability of switching between the two systems, pretty much no matter what the task is, whether it's a cognitive thing in terms of, you know, sort of rational applications, or whether it is probabilistic thinking, or whether it is even moral behavior, that we seem to have the or certainly mechanical task, we simply have to have this ability. Seem to have this ability to switch between the two systems, and when we become better and better at something, then we automate the process.
Yep. I mean, so that's one of the main reasons why I'm optimistic about a lot of rational decision-making habits becoming automatic over time. Right. In addition to anecdotal evidence from myself and a bunch of other people I know who have been really keen on rationality for the last few years, that I have observed things becoming automatic in myself. So,
yes,
yeah, I'm optimistic, but we're also collecting a lot of data. We're running a randomized controlled trial on... So we admitted twice as many people to our last series of workshops than we actually had space for, and we got them all ahead of time to take both a reasoning test and also an in-depth survey of various metrics of life success and satisfaction, like how many times in the last... month or 2 weeks or whatever, have you made decisions that you later regretted? Or how often do you find yourself procrastinating? How satisfied are you with your professional life or your love life and so on? So we collected all this data and then we essentially flipped a coin and admitted half of them to our workshops and half of them did not get admitted. And then we're following up with them in, I think, 6 months and then 12 months to see whether the change in reasoning ability and or life success is greater in the group that came than in the group that didn't. And I'm sure that a lot of the stuff that we're trying is going to turn out in retrospect not to have worked that well, or not to have worked optimally compared to other things we could have done. Mm-hmm. So the point of collecting the research collecting the data is not just to contribute to the body of knowledge about devising, but also for our own benefit so that we can, you know, iteratively improve our classes.
Now, we have only a few minutes left, but let me bring up one more issue and see your thoughts about this, which is one of the articles that I read talked about the potential barriers to debiasing, of which there are several. You know, one of them is, of course, the bias blind spot, meaning that people are going to say, I'm not biased. What are you talking about?
Uh-huh.
So that's one thing. The other one is... people have to be convinced that what they're learning in terms of debiasing is actually relevant to their personal welfare, to the things that actually matter to them, which I guess you're trying to address by moving to as practical applications as possible. The other problem that these authors bring up is that currently the research simply is not capable of telling us whether debiasing programs need to be repeated or sustained over time. That's an interesting question. I mean, you know, it's like, do you need booster shots for your debiasing? Another one is the cultural differences. So, you know, perhaps certain programs might work with certain types of individuals belonging to a culture or gender and not others necessarily, because there obviously is variation in the human population for these kinds of things. So there are others, but what are your thoughts and how you guys are going to sort of take that into consideration on these ones?
So I'll start with the first. The first was the bias blind spot, people don't think they're actually biased. And there are a couple, I have a couple of responses to that. One is that at least in the near term, we're selecting for people who are already interested in and receptive to the idea of improving their decision-making skills.
Right.
So we're not going out and trying to convince people who are really resistant that they should learn about rationality. That would be great if we could achieve that eventually, but it's not the low-hanging fruit. And then the other response is that there are actually a lot of fun exercises or demonstrations that you can do to reveal to people that they're biased. Like the you may have at some point played the overconfidence game, where you ask people to estimate various quantities, just all sorts of questions, like the height of Mount Everest or how many platinum records this or that artist had, and so on. And you ask them to give a 90% confidence interval for their estimate. So, you know, a lower bound and an upper bound within which they are 90% confident the true answer falls. And again, just about every time this experiment is performed, only about 50% of the true answers are actually within people's 90% confidence intervals. So this is like a really stark and unambiguous demonstration of an overconfidence bias. There's a bunch of other things you can do to show people that they actually have biases. And then the second thing you brought up was...
Well, the additional one was, actually was the third one. You have addressed right the first two. It was a cultural... there's a need for sustained sort of program or repeated programs or, you know, booster shots.
One of the ways that we're addressing this question is through the development of rationality apps or games, like for the iPhone or Android. So I was talking about overconfidence, and I was also talking earlier about the importance of practicing skills on the kinds of issues that you want to be good at them at. Issues in your real life. So this game called the prediction game asks people to make predictions about things in their life, like upcoming issues that are going to get resolved one way or the other. Like, is my boss going to say yes when I ask for a raise? Or even little things like how much is the total for the groceries I'm carrying going to be? And people are prompted to attach a confidence level to their estimates and then asked at the requisite time how it actually turned out, so that people can get a sense over time of how overconfident or underconfident they are in various domains of their life.
Right.
So that's one example. But then the other thing I would say to the booster shot question is that one of the reasons that we're doing these workshops in person is not just to teach people about biases, but to create a community, a network of people who are excited about rationality and motivated to try to improve their own rationality. Because one of the biggest effects in terms of actually changing the way people think and behave is the effect of the community that they're in. And I've seen this personally myself to a large degree, that I find myself surrounded by people who display strong rationality habits and who say things like, oh, that's a good argument. I hadn't realized X, Y, or Z. I'm changing my mind now. Or people who ask just, you know, reflexively ask, let's see, what evidence could we look for that would help us settle that question? And so that, like, repeatedly keeps the stuff on my radar screen and also provides these nice role models for me to aspire to. So that's one of the things that we're, at CIFAR, we're trying to create in addition to the curricula.
Right. Although, that, as you said, that means that the audience is going to be largely self-selected. I mean, if we're talking about... you know, communities of people who are already interested, which is fine. I think that one of the things that concerns me more broadly is how do you bring this kind of stuff to a general population? Because frankly, it's nice to improve the rationality of people who already think rationality is important. The next question is how to convince almost everybody else that rationality should even be on the plate. But that's a discussion for another time.
Yeah, I mean, I think once the data starts coming in and we have a sense of what the most useful rationality techniques are in terms of improving people's own personal lives, that'll be increasingly motivating for people who aren't interested in the rationality just inherently, but still want to, you know, have better careers or love lives or health or get rich and so on. I mean, the audience of self-help is huge, despite the fact that most self-help is not at all empirically validated or founded in theory. Right. So that was part of the reasoning behind framing our classes as being about helping you achieve your own personal goals, despite the fact that we also, and one of the reasons that we're doing this, think that making people more rational will have positive effects on society and the world as a whole. But yeah, I completely agree with you that it would be wonderful if we could make the whole world rational and not just the self-selected part of the population. But
that's,
you know,
right. Exactly. Anyway.
Anyway, so we are over time now. I got too excited talking about applied rationality. But since we're out of time, let's move on now to the Rationally Speaking picks.
Welcome back. Every episode, Julie and I pick a couple of our favorite books, movies, websites, or whatever tickles our rational fancy. Let's start, as usual, with Julia's pick.
Thanks, Masso. I'm going to cheat very slightly and give two picks, one of which is the website for my organization, the Center for Applied Rationality. It's appliedrationality.org. You can find out about all the cool things that we're doing, and you can also sign up to be notified of upcoming rationality workshops. So then my other pick is the blog of Dan Ariely, who's the researcher who wrote Predictably Irrational. It's a really enjoyable blog, not just because he's a great writer with a really friendly and conversational voice, and he talks about a lot of interesting research, but he also ties it into like everyday life issues. So one of my favorite posts from him was about how email is perfectly, like, the experience of checking your email is perfectly calibrated to be addictive, the same way roulette machines at casinos are perfectly calibrated to be addictive. So we'll link to that post as well, but I recommend reading a lot of his work. It's really enjoyable.
Okay. My pick, on the other hand, is a paper that came out recently in Nature magazine. And it's called Measuring the Evolution of Contemporary Western Popular Music by Joan Serra and several other collaborators. And what I found interesting was that, you know, they applied quantitative methodologies to the evolution of music from the 1950s, I think, to until modern time. And they found some interesting things, one of which was, for instance, let me read you from the abstract of the paper. Many of the patterns and metrics that they measured have been consistently stable for a period of over 50 years. In other words, music hasn't really changed that much over the last 50 years. But they prove important changes or trends related to the restriction of pitch transitions, the homogenization of the timbral palette, and the growing loudness levels. In other words, modern music is less variable and more loud than it used to be a few decades ago. That's pretty much the bottom line. Now, some commentators have interpreted this to show, for instance, that there's one of the graphs in the article that shows a peak in a measure called beta, which is a measure of diversity, variation, basically, in the way that people do music. It peaked, that one peaked in the 1960s. And so some commentators have been interpreting this somewhat tongue-in-cheek, possibly, as, you know, the fact that music was actually really better, demonstrably, scientifically better in the 60s than it is now. but of course, a different interpretation is simply it was more variable, which means there was more crap produced in the 1960s. And that things sort of converged to a particular aesthetic standard, whatever that aesthetic standard, of course, might be. So anyway, it's an interesting article because it makes you think about what happens when you apply quantitative measures to otherwise, you know, entirely aesthetic questions, such as, you know, what is the quality of these pieces of music?
Cool. I'm glad you added that addendum about alternative interpretations, because otherwise you're going to make even more insufferable the people who are always talking about how everything was better when they were children.
Exactly.
So thank you for avoiding that pitfall. we are now out of time, so this concludes another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.